What a lovely day for a fishing trip in Gloucester.
You're not my husband.
Oh, come now, Doris. I went through hundreds of profiles on Match.com, and yours was the best. Now, if I can just find my tackle box.
My husband was a terrible man, but at least he never pretended to be a fisherman.
Now, Doris, I am no mere tourist. Although I am somewhat inexperienced in matters pertaining to fishing, I have read many books on the subject. I have practiced my line hook using a string in a newspaper.
Take me home. You're a bore.
But we came all this way.
I'll spring for gas money if you'll just shut your tourist trap. Bring back my husband!
Okay, so I am here with Mark Kurlansky, who is the author of Salt and Cod, and most recently, The Last Fish Tale, and you have a wonderful dog here as well. Mark, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. So is my wonderful dog.
Yes. I wanted to first of all ask a very kind of general question to start this off with. I mean, you point to several skirmishes among the Gloucester residency. I mean, the environmentalists versus the fishermen, the ethnic concentration. At one point, you talk about the exclusiveness of certain homes. But I'm wondering if this is a case where an outsider can truly understand the city, not the town, of Gloucester. Because I'm wondering if this book, like your other books, serves as a way to get into the thick of things, or if it's a matter of really having this prism with which to view humanity. Is this kind of how you approach something? Do you not really want to be in the thick of things, or what's the deal here?
I was trying to do two things with this book. One is I really was trying to express the uniqueness of this town. Mm-hmm. But it seems like a contradiction, but at the same time, I was trying to express the universality of the town, the fact that it's an iconic place, the first and oldest fishing port in the United States. Mm-hmm. And I want people to better understand the whole problem of fishing and fisheries, and I feel that it is not very well understood, and it's not understood in human terms, and I can't think of a better place to explain it, a better way to explain it than to look at Gloucester. Although, you know, as you know, I take a look at a few other fishing towns in the book as well, but people sometimes either credit or blame me, depending on your point of view, with having played some role in making people more aware of the crisis in the oceans. And if that's true, I'm not feeling good about it, because I find that people, although they've become more aware of it, they don't understand it at all. They just think, oh, those awful fishermen are out there raping the ocean, and my God, can't somebody stop them? Yeah. And it's that's not really what it is.
Well, there is one chapter late in this book that continues that thread of the problem with fish stock. Right. In fact, the thing that's funny about that chapter is that despite all these introductions and these attempts at remedies, you have a situation in which, well, there is no real solution to this. Fishermen must either adapt to this idea of ever-changing rules. The only actual solution you propose is to raise the price of fish. So I'm wondering if this is a situation in which you stumble upon this problem and it's just far too complex to offer a simple solution, or if it's just something that maybe America just takes for granted in a nutshell.
I think there are solutions. I'm actually not proposing raising the price of fish as a solution. Raising the price of fish, I think, is an inevitable byproduct of the solution.
Yeah.
I think the solution, you know, you have two choices. Fishermen are extremely regulated, and stocks have nevertheless been declining. So you can either further regulate them, and they're getting to the point where it's becoming difficult to earn a living. There's so much regulations. Yeah. You know, their days at sea are controlled, and some of them are allowed, you know, 30, 40 days a year at sea. That's not viable. The other alternative is to look at the ways of fishing that have gotten us into this problem and just stop them.
Yeah.
Stop bottom dragging.
Yeah.
First of all, I mean, I've spent a lot of time researching the history of commercial fishing in the North Atlantic. Perhaps an odd thing to do, but and it's very clear to me that there is an exact parallel between the development of bottom draggers and the decline in fish stocks.
Yeah.
You know, starting in the 1880s when they first invented the things and used them in the southern part of the North Sea, and, you know, within a decade, those stocks were declining and the fishermen were taking it up to the northern part of the North Sea. And, you know, from there it expanded. Make this a viable idea of just banning the what is really the principal means of fishing groundfish, which is most commercial fish, you have to have a lot of cooperation of government and financial centers and basically subsidize getting the fishermen out of this fishing and into another kind of fishing. But, you know, that's how they got into this fishing in the first place. It was subsidized, and they got soft loans and things. And now they have, you know, these huge, very expensive vessels that gasoline is too expensive to run them anyway. And you know, they're in debt up to their ears. Mm-hmm. And you can't just say, well, you can't use them anymore. I guess you could, but it wouldn't be reasonable and wouldn't be politically viable.
Yeah.
But I think that if you had a program to get them to another kind of fishing, that this could work. And when you talk about, I mean, it's a counterintuitive thing, because really what you're talking about is undoing technology, going back to less efficient technology. Fishermen who fish inefficiently, the ultimate example being a hand line with a single hook, no matter how good they are and how many days a year and how many hours a day, they're not going to overfish.
Yes.
So you've solved the regulatory problem right there.
Yeah.
And they can go back to the ways of thinking that have always marked fishermen, trying to figure out how to get as many fish and you know, working it out on their own without having government on their backs and looking over their shoulder. But the question is, how is it going to be economically viable for fishermen to go back to techniques in which they catch substantially less fish?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think clearly the answer is that the fish has to draw a higher price.
Yeah.
And you get that higher price by making it a more high-quality fish.
Yeah.
Landing it really fresh. And, you know, the great news in all of this is that fish that are caught by sustainable methods like hook and line are in much better shape than in unsustainable methods like bottom draggers. And if you saw a fish caught in a bottom dragger net and a fish caught by hook and line next to each other, I guarantee, even if you know nothing about fish, I guarantee you'd want the one on the hook and line, and you'd be willing to pay more money to get it. I mean,
And there's also the bycatch as well.
Well, you mean the fact that there are
additional species of fish that are caught in a trawl method?
Yes. There's very little bycatch in a hook and line fishery. There is some, as you know, if you've ever been sports fishing and you're going after striper and all of a sudden you've got a blue or, you know, a flounder. I've caught flounder, which is, the wrong level of the ocean. But, these things happen, but they don't happen on a large scale. Whereas in a bottom dragger, 40% of your catch could be bycatch, which is to say species other than the species that you were targeting.
This particular chapter is extremely interesting, though, because you present a scenario in which the government regulation results in a number of fish being dumped into the sea because it's excess weight. Simultaneously, you also point to the fact that a lot of these fishermen are capable of understanding this notion of wiping out a species and are willing to be innovative in their own right to try to protect their trade. So it's almost as if you have a scenario here in which there really is no easy solution. I mean, on one hand, you could trust the fishermen, but then you have, of course, the great continental argument over which country gets the particular waters or gets the particular banks and the like. And so I'm wondering if really raising the price of fish seems to me, at least based off of reading the book, that seemed to me the only logical conclusion here to solve this problem. Which one is better? I don't know.
Assuming, you know, that fish are coming from sustainable fisheries,
yeah,
and, you know, otherwise it's not really that you raise the price of fish. If you fish sustainably, the quality of fish will increase, will improve, and the size of the catch will, so the market supply will be less. And therefore, it's a, what is the Keynesian word for it? It's a market function. It will just...
Trickle down?
It will... No, it won't trickle down. It absolutely won't. But the price will naturally rise.
Yeah.
It's not something you can do artificially. It would accomplish nothing to just artificially raise the price of fish.
So is there really a solution to this, or is this constant experimentation from both the fishermen and the government?
Yes to both of those. It is. I mean, part of the problem is that there was no really serious attempt to regulate fisheries until the 1970s, and really, it didn't get serious until the 1990s. It wasn't until the 1990s that everybody realized that, you know, fishing regulations had to be really tough. So there isn't a lot of experience with how to regulate fisheries, and they are often not successfully regulated despite the best efforts of the government, the regulators, and the fishermen, and everybody really trying to do this right.
Mm-hmm.
And mistakes get made. What I'm saying is that if you limit fishing to ways in which it's virtually impossible to overfish, then you're not as dependent on regulation.
Mm-hmm.
There would still have to be some regulation, for example, controlling how many people were using these sustainable methods.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
What we're trying to do now is use equipment that's capable of scooping up every last fish in the world and finding ways of controlling it so that it doesn't.
Yeah.
And that has proven to be a very difficult thing to do. So possibly it's not the way to go. Possibly you just have to ban, you know, I mean, there are methods of fishing that have been banned. You know,
yeah,
you can't dynamite fish anymore.
Yeah.
That's a good thing. And a lot of equipment has been restricted. You now have to have a much larger mesh size on nets, which a lot of fishermen had done voluntarily before it was regulated, because it's very obvious to fishermen that it's disastrous to take small fish.
Mm-hmm.
Certain kinds of rock hoppers and things and dragger nets that are very destructive to the bottom have been outlawed. And so the idea of outlawing certain types of fishing equipment is not a new idea, but it's a question of, you know, how far are you willing to go with that? I think it's obvious that, you know, we have to go farther with something.
Yeah. But from a historical standpoint, it almost seems to me that technology is always the thing that is making a serious dent into the fish population. For example, with Gorton's and the dry freezing process that in 1921 completely revolutionized and transformed the fishing industry. There was all this skin and excess fish stock that they were trying to figure out what to do with. People were trying to determine whether they can turn them to glue. But this seems almost absolutely parallel to the amazing amount of fish that are now being dumped into the sea because of these particular requirements. So I'm wondering if this is just an inevitable historical cycle that technology and fish really don't go along very well.
Well, you know, there's two things here, because first of all, the dumping of fish into the sea is not a technological problem; it's a bureaucratic problem.
Mm-hmm.
An example I give in my book is a Gloucester fisherman who, when fishing quotas on cod were first announced, and I can't remember the figure, but it was something like 500 pounds a day that he was allowed to take. He went out and he caught 1,500 pounds. He came in, he told the regulators, I have 1,500 pounds. This is 3 days of fishing. And they said, no, it's not. It's 1 day of fishing and you have to throw out 1,000 pounds.
Yeah.
And he said, why? You know, because that's the regulation. Yeah. You know, it's bureaucracy. And quotas inevitably lead to... The thing people have to understand is that fish, particularly from bottom draggers, but in general, most fish that are caught are dead by the time you get them on deck.
Yeah, but in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, you have Gordons moving from cod to redfish over the years. I mean, they had to have seen that this was a serious problem, that they were diminishing their fish stocks. I mean, there was the efforts by the fishermen to try to say, oh, we can use all of this excess fish for fertilizer and the like. But still, the fish populations were deteriorated. I mean, there was no foresight here, just as there seems to be no foresight in this bureaucratic process now underway.
I mean, there always have been people, and particularly fishermen, who have seen these problems. I mean, there were fishermen in Europe talking about overfishing in the Middle Ages and concerned about how nets were laid. And it's not a question of not seeing it. It's a question of sometimes it's a question of failing to come up with an effective solution. And sometimes it's a problem of an inability to get the bureaucracy to move.
Yeah.
And political problems. New Bedford, Massachusetts, which, you know, Gloucester, New Bedford, and Point Judith are really the only big-time fishing ports left in New England. New Bedford is a big-time dragger port and represented in Congress by Congressman Barney Frank. And, you know, he's not interested in my proposal to ban bottom draggers because, you know, all his voters in New Bedford are going to be really mad at him, not just the fishermen and the fishermen's families, but, you know, as I'm trying to show in my book, it creates a culture that's important to everybody in the community, and the community wants to preserve these things. Yeah. So there are political problems also. But I think these political problems are solvable. As I say, you don't just ban bottom draggers. You get government and financial cooperation and develop a
you get dogs you to get go dogs, ahead and shake poodles. Their ways and yeah, poodles yeah
to come up with a program to make it viable for fishermen to change what they do.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you also allude to some of the problems of Massachusetts politics. Like, for example, on Gloucester, there really isn't a concern for whether a candidate is Republican or Democrat. And, of course, at the very get-go, I had alluded to the environmentalist versus fisherman problem, in which they were once previously allied, and now they are at loggerheads because natural gas, which is a legitimate renewable energy, is in their mind an affront to the fishing industry.
Well, it's an interesting comparison because, you know, some years ago the oil companies wanted to drill for oil on George's Bank.
Yeah.
And the fishermen and the environmentalists cooperated beautifully in getting this blocked. But in the last few years, the state of Massachusetts has wanted to put these liquid natural gas plants out at sea. And nobody has really made a case that this is harmful to fishing, although some fishermen have tried to.
Yeah.
there's no real evidence of that. But the problem is that it means huge swaths of fishing ground that become off limits to everyone.
Yeah.
And, you know, fishing grounds are getting hard to come by these days, so they're upset with that. The environmentalists wouldn't get on board with them because it wasn't an environmental problem.
Yeah.
But I think the problem between environmentalists and fishermen is more fundamental, and it's really unfortunate because their goals are identical. I think that environmentalists are often extremely careless and insensitive in the way they talk about not only fishermen. I mean, you know, when there's an issue of a polluting factory, they tend not to be sensitive to the jobs that are potentially eliminated by closing it down, and they tend not to approach these issues from the worker's point of view. In this case, the worker being the fisherman, and they need to understand that from the fisherman's perspective, he is out there at sea, risking his life and struggling for the survival of his way of life and earning a living. And as the fish stocks decline, there is more and more funding for environmental groups. These guys don't go to sea. They don't risk their lives.
Yeah.
And they're actually prospering on the crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Now, personally, I don't criticize them for that. But, you know, that's the fisherman's way of looking at it. And all I'm saying there is that environmentalists need the cooperation of fishermen. And if they want the cooperation of fishermen, they have to be extremely sensitive to the fact that fishermen view them that way.
But I'm also wondering if it's a matter of this obdurate Gloucester character that you allude to many times throughout the book.
Absolutely.
That, I mean, you know, I was curious about the whole Elsie versus Blue Nose race, whether you actually write that essentially they didn't have time to deal with this great defeat, that they were more concerned with fishing. And in a desperate effort to sort of determine whether this was true, I was digging through the New York Times archive, and I found this particular quote from Captain Martin Welch in a 1921 article. He basically says, "I've no excuses. The larger boat won because the Elsie is as good as the Blue Nose, only she's smaller. Give me a vessel of that size and I'd like to race her every day of the week." So this seems to me either a sense of Gloucester bluster or perhaps a notion of some kind of pride. I mean, what is this exactly?
In that particular case, and it was a different era.
Yeah.
And you have to remember that schooners were invented in Gloucester, and they were invented as fishing boats.
Yes.
And so fishermen had this tremendous pride that they were the master of schooners, and they became yachts. Today, the only schooners around, except for in a few museums, are yachts and for racing. And, you know, fishermen, it's the same sort of thing as with, you know, the environmentalists. You know, these aren't real men of the sea, you know, these are just rich guys who are playing around on these boats, and you know, we're the guys who know how to handle a schooner.
And then on top of everything else, the Canadians decide to put the Blue Nose on their stamps
on
and the dime and everything. And you know, my girlfriend's Canadian, and I asked her about the Blue Nose, and she kind of gave me a slight grin, and so I'm like, come on, you know, give the Gloucester guys something.
Well, the Blue Nose visits, you know, there's a new...
The Blue Nose 4, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, I saw that.
Gloucester, one of the unusual charms, I think, of Gloucester is that it is very determinedly a blue-collar place.
Yeah.
And it takes a tremendous pride in its blue-collarness. And it's a community in which there are a number of extremely wealthy people, and they all get along pretty well, and they socialize. And in a way, it is the classless society, except that there is this tremendous awareness of class and of the ethos of you know, working class people. And you have to be aware of that if you want to deal with Gloucester. You know?
Yeah. Well, I also wanted to ask you about the relationship between fishing and tourism. You propose that if we were to have a hypothetical line graph with two lines, one rising and one declining, that X would have occurred at the 1970s. And the book ends on a note of, well, perhaps the tourism might actually overtake the fishing aspect of Gloucester. But simultaneously, you have this downtown area that is zoned only for commercial fishing.
Well, this is the thing about Gloucester, that there is a remarkable determination of a considerable portion of the Gloucester population not to let Gloucester go the way of other New England fishing ports. I mean, three quarters of it. When I was a kid, when I was a teenager, I worked on commercial fishing boats, and I used to go from port to port. And most of the ports that I knew are no longer fishing ports. They're, you know, resort places, yachts, summer homes. Gloucester people are determined not to let that happen. There's a new mayor now, which, you know, I mean, they're two-year terms, so there's often new mayors.
Yeah.
But the new mayor has been holding hearings in which they've just invited townspeople, you know, just to get an earful of, you know, when you ask for an earful from Gloucester people, you really get it, you know?
And there's, of course, the gentleman who runs every term as well, who's been doing that for 30 years.
Dan Riverdy, yes.
Yeah.
But, you know, somebody was estimating to me that something like 1,000 people have shown up for these small little groups to talk to the mayor.
Yeah.
And, you know, what they talk about is, you know, the phrase that's always used is how to keep Gloucester, Gloucester. Mm-hmm. And the formula that they're more or less looking for, they aren't anti-tourism, and they would, in fact, like to have more tourism. Everybody around them has lots of tourism. But they want to preserve the town as a fishing town, and they have been doing that largely through zoning. By, you know, we can have tourism, but, you know, keep them out of the harbor and off of the waterfront.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, I'm wondering if this is a situation in which there is obviously this obstinacy working hand in hand with this idea of, well, come on in because we could use your money. I didn't quite figure from your book exactly what's going on in Gloucester with this sort of double standard, because
well, it's come on in, but don't come into the harbor.
Yeah.
For instance, I know developers who are very keen on the idea of, you know, there isn't one major first-class hotel in Gloucester.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's developers who would very much like to see that happen, but they're very careful about where that hotel would be placed. Mm-hmm. The idea is that if you had a bunch of touristic things on the downtown waterfront, you would never get that land back.
Yeah.
Stonington, Connecticut, and Mystic, Connecticut are never going back to commercial fishing. Commercial fishermen could no longer afford mooring in that harbor or using that waterfront property. It's all, they've been priced out.
Yeah.
And that's what Gloucester people don't want to see happen. But that isn't to say that they wouldn't like to get in on, you know, the tourism industry, which is one of the fastest growing industries in the world.
Is it because Gloucester is having money problems and has had money problems for the last 10, 15 years? Or?
Yes. They have tremendous money problems. The schools are in terrible shape. Fire stations have been closed. The state of Massachusetts has mandated an improvement and expansion of their sewer system, and they don't have the money for it. The historic and beautiful city hall is falling apart, and they're having trouble coming up with the money to restore it. Parts of the roof fall into the balcony of the mayor's office during meetings,
which
people would argue is a very Gloucester thing, you know?
Yeah. Well, I also wanted to ask you, just kind of changing tacks a bit, one thing I've been very curious about in your books as a whole is that it's extremely dangerous to read these on an empty stomach, because you frequently throw in recipes throughout your books. Do you feel that a recipe really reveals what a particular topic, or in this case, a location like Gloucester, really is all about? There's this really great 1751 recipe that is almost poetic in the way that it describes chowder. It reminded me of the chowder chapter for Moby Dick. But why all the recipes in this? This is a kind of entry point for people, or is this
I just have this. I mean, this is something that's in almost all of my books. I just believe that recipes are great archaeological artifacts that tell you a lot about a culture and a people. Mm-hmm. Many of the recipes in this book, the Gloucester recipes, because I also have some recipes from Newland, many of the Gloucester recipes are Portuguese and Sicilian. And, you know, that's, you know, Gloucester, if you want to talk about Gloucester food, you can talk about cod and you can talk about chowder, but, you know, there's a Portuguese Azorean, really, sausage called linguiça, which is, you know, commonly eaten by everybody in Gloucester. You can buy it in the supermarket.
Yeah.
And, you know, cannolis and espresso is very Gloucester, you know. One of the interesting things about food and recipes is that they reflect not only economic changes, but ethnic and cultural changes. And people kind of forget about that, you know. I mean, you know, Gloucester, which was founded by Puritans in 1623, you know, is a very Catholic town with a fair number of Jews, and you know, it's not Pilgrim New England anymore. And you really see that in the food.
There was one thing that I was curious about. You observe many times throughout the history of Gloucester that, despite the development of the barometer, people really didn't develop technology to detect whether they should go out to sea.
Right.
There's one subject that you interview in which, even in the early 20th century, they determine whether to go out to sea based off of how hard the laundry is flapping against the wind. And I'm wondering why there was less of an emphasis on safety. Were you able to determine why the technology was not applied to this? Because, I mean, there were many lives lost.
Yeah, it's a good point. Technology was not largely... technology was applied to catching more fish, getting the fish to market faster, and not to safety in any way. I mean, if you just look at the history of the schooner, schooners became faster and faster and more dangerous, and there was nobody working on schooner design to make them safer.
Mm-hmm.
While it was extremely tragic, the losses they had, and had a tremendous effect on the whole culture and mentality of the town, it was accepted that you would lose fishermen and new fishermen would come. That's why there's so much immigration to Gloucester. And the idea of using technology in fishing for safety is a relatively new idea. And, you know, some great things have come about. Most of them were not invented for the fishing industry. I mean, like cell phones and satellite phones. I mean, what lifesavers those are for fishermen. You know, you go down, you get on your raft, and you call up the Coast Guard, you give them their position, and you keep talking to them until, yes, I see you on the horizon, you know. And there are also things that have been developed for fishermen, like textiles that, you know, are a lightweight and you can move in them, but their flotation, they'll keep you floating if you fall in the water, and, you know, thermal protection which comes in handy in the North Atlantic.
But what oceanographers are there in Gloucester? I mean, when did oceanography even become a reality, is something to rely upon? I mean, you point out that the Gloucester people are not stupid. They're well-read. They read Shakespeare. They read a number of things.
In fact, historically, Gloucester had a reputation for being among the more literate and educated of New England fishermen. Accounts in the 19th century talk about how Gloucester fishermen, unlike most New England fishermen, you know, lived in nice, good, solid houses, and they took good books with them out to sea, and they were not in any way backwards people.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, you're talking about the tip. Boston, you can see Boston on a clear day from Gloucester Harbor.
Yeah. But there's also this notion of danger in the tales that come from Gloucester, like Howard Blackburn freezing and losing his toes and his fingers, and yet there is this constant influx of newcomers. I mean, what accounts for people constantly coming in despite these dangers? Is the lucre, is the possibility of money really, this outweighs any sense of mortal danger? Were you able to determine over the course of Gloucester history whether there were worries or flags raised for, hey, don't go to Gloucester because you're going to lose your life?
Well, it was talked about in Gloucester. I mean, in the Gloucester papers, they'd say, you know, why does anybody do this winter George's Bank fishery when it's so dangerous? You know, and There's a few answers to that. It was profitable, but you know, when I was a kid, and I got jobs on commercial fishing boats, you know, my family did. I was from Hartford. I didn't come from exactly a maritime family, and you know, people didn't really understand, you know, why I wanted to do this, and I loved being at sea, and I was certainly aware of the danger. Worked with a lot of fishermen who were missing fingers. You can lose fingers very easily, and you know, I was very aware of all of that. But you know, when I look back on my memories, I don't have memories of being particularly worried about the danger. I have memories of how much I loved being at sea, and what a great camaraderie there was with other fishermen, and how you had this special life kind of out on your own. And you know, I always remember this feeling when you'd come back to port and you'd look at people and you think, oh, those poor suckers stuck on land all the time. It's a life that just appeals to some people.
I also wanted to ask you about the stone cutting, which you allude to. You described the fact that there are Finnish immigrants who came in the early 20th century for granite, which was in fact used for both the Brooklyn Bridge, even the Holland Tunnel, a number of things in Boston as well. And yet,
Havana, the streets of Havana were paved.
Yeah, and but the thing I was curious about with this was it really economic factors that led to Cape Ann granite being used for all these structures, or was there something specific about the granite? And also, I'm curious, in 1901, there was a high-speed rail that was observed by the mayor of Gloucester and various other people, because, and they were worried that it was going too fast. But you allude to a rail that was constructed in 1871, and I'm wondering why you skipped out on this particular granite, the Gloucester Granite Company that came in favor of this. Because I was curious also to go back to where I started with this question about why, what attracted Finnish immigrants over, say, Sicilians to the granite industry, towards this really dangerous, even more dangerous than fishing, one might argue.
Well, certainly less healthy.
Yeah.
I think they were stone cutters. Mm-hmm. You know, the people who came to Gloucester came with skills. So the stone cutters went to the quarries and the fishermen went to the waterfront. Mm-hmm. The granite, Cape Ann granite, is a special granite in that it is extremely hard and dense. And granite like that is rarely found close to the surface as it is in Gloucester. So that's why it was a very valuable rock. Mm-hmm. I wrote about it because it's part of the story. It's not my central story. My central story is about a fishing community, and you know, a part of Gloucester broke off and became Rockport, which was a very different town than Gloucester. Didn't have a good harbor, and consequently wasn't a big fishing center. It was the non-fishing north side of Gloucester that became this separate town, and that's where most of the granite quarries were.
Yeah.
So granite is much more of a Rockport story than a Gloucester story.
Got it. I also wanted to ask you about the Luminists as well as Fitzhenry Lane. You write that Gloucester's art world began with Fitzhenry Lane and was always steeped in a tradition that many of its painters, such as Davis and Meyerowitz, never quite fit in. And I'm curious why they may have resented Davis and Meyerowitz. Is it because Fitzhenry Lane was a native, or was there something else?
No. Emil Gruppe, who, you know, is actually the cover is an Emil Gruppe painting, and you know, Emil Gruppe is one of the most loved Gloucester painters, and not a native. And I could give you many other examples of people who are not natives, but Gloucester people tend to like a certain kind of maritime painting. Mm-hmm. And you know, there was that school of painting, and then there were these people, mainly from New York, which isn't to say that the other ones were from Gloucester, but they were from a lot of different places. But there were these New York artists like Stuart Davis and John Sloan and people who came up to Gloucester because Gloucester had become a place for artists to go and were not really doing that kind of painting. And Meyerowitz, and you know, who was born in a shtetl in Russia and wasn't really a maritime guy at all. And Gloucester people, and some of these people became, you know, some of the most successful artists in Gloucester history, but the Gloucester people never really understood their paintings. They, you know, liked paintings of fishermen and fishing boats in the harbor and things like that. Edward Hopper spent a lot of time in Gloucester and did a lot of paintings. He never painted a boat. He never painted the ocean. He just painted houses. You know.
Did the Gloucester people like Hopper in your research, or did you find any resentment towards Hopper? I was curious because you...
Well, you know, these painters weren't, they weren't resented, they just didn't understand what they were doing, you know, and so, you know, most Gloucester people considered, you know, Emil Gruppe to be, you know, a far more important painter than Edward Hopper or Stuart Davis, and you know, most of the art world would tend to disagree with that.
Was it a matter of the painter meshing and understanding the Gloucester character, or was it the paintings themselves that reflected this true maritime quality?
Well, you know, the Gloucester art started with people like FitzHenry Lane and the Luminists, and you know, he happened to be a Gloucester person, but others came who weren't. But they were all about showing a certain quality of light that, that a seaport has, and so they did these beautiful canvases of the harbor and things like that on maritime themes. Lane originally painted ships, being a Gloucester person, with tremendous accuracy for the rigging and things like that, and was a very important painter in the world. I mean, the Luminists were important, and then Impressionists came there, and Post-Impressionists, and by and large, you know, all of these people did maritime things. Marsden Hartley didn't. He was obsessed with rocks. The rocks are great in Gloucester. You know, I did all the drawings for the book.
I noticed that. I was going to ask.
You might have noticed that a lot of them are rocks.
And motif number one as well.
Well, you had to, you know.
But do people still draw motif number one? It's just one of those things that won't go away.
Right. But what started happening as Gloucester became more and more of a famous place for artists is... all of these New York artists came, who were modernists, you know, post-impressionists, and they weren't really there for maritime themes. They were there because it was a nice place for an artist to be, and they did art that wasn't completely understood locally, because locals were into the idea that, you know, the artists come and paint their ships in their harbor. And Stuart Davis actually did, but, you know, he did it in ways that
were more impressionistic.
Well, beyond impression, I'm not sure exactly what the word would be, but, you know, they were very they had a lot to do with lines and very sort of interesting, complicated composition, and very far from realism of any kind. You know, these people had tremendous artistic careers, and it's now, you know, it's a part of Gloucester heritage, and the Gloucester people are really glad, you know, that they were there, and there's this wonderful museum in Gloucester that has all of these painters. But, you know, if they could get their hands on one to put in their home, it would probably be a Gruppe or, you know, one of those seascapes or something. But And some people do have good paintings in their homes, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's... that's always been true of Gloucester that, T.S. Eliot spent a lot of time there and he wrote about Gloucester. And,
alluding to it in The Wasteland as well.
Well, in The Wasteland had a huge passage on Gloucester, which I found in the New York Public Library, which was never published because Ezra Pound cut it. But the New York Public Library has the original, I think, pencil-written manuscript from T.S. Eliot that he gave to Pound with Pound's notes on it, and Pound just crossed out all these passages about Gloucester.
Yeah.
One of the quartets is about Gloucester, though. It's not that people in Gloucester ever sat around reading a lot of T.S. Eliot either, you know.
Yeah. there's one last question I want to ask you, and this is largely in terms of process. I noticed that in reading this book, in the bibliography, you have a lot of primary sources that you draw from, and you're very specific about the oral histories that you draw from. Where you are not specific about is your own particular journalism or the interviews that you did. Mm-hmm. I must conclude that if the name is not listed as an oral history interview, that you actually went out there and interviewed that. But I'm wondering if this is really fair game for journalism. I mean, every journalist has their own, or historian for that matter, has their own particular form of approaching and assembling the facts. But I'm wondering if you feel that having very specific citation along these lines gets in the way of the narrative. I mean, like, how does someone like me, for example, who wants to know where specific facts come from, follow these particular facts if there's nothing to match anything up here?
Well, the reason why in the bibliography I'm specific about the oral histories is it's kind of the reverse. It's to tell you that these are people that I did not interview.
Yeah.
I do find that sort of annotating kind of gets in the way of the narrative, and I don't do it very much. I've only done one book, my 1968 book, that did give notes with a lot of details for sources of things. But I think it's probably clearer in the reading of it. I mean, you know, if I'm quoting somebody and, you know, they're around now, that, you know, I talk to them and and it's not a reasonable thing to expect the reader to go to Gloucester and talk to these people.
Yeah.
I mean, the things that are in the bibliography are things that they can do in a library. They can get these oral histories and they can, you know, get these newspaper clips and the books and things like that, reports.
But why not list all of the people you talk to and interview, just to be absolutely clear for anybody who has any particular problems with discrepancy of facts? Or is this kind of a scenario
I don't know that the people I interview would particularly want me to do that, actually.
It's not really
part of the deal that I'm giving all my readers access to these people. Some of these people are very private people, and everybody's sort of used to me around Gloucester, so you know they'll talk to me. But that could become nightmarish if
some intrepid scholar going to check your book and all that. I mean, how did you befriend a lot of these people or get them to talk with you if everybody is so private and everybody is so kind of obdurate in their own way? Was it a matter of just really wanting to understand what it is to be a Gloucester resident? This goes back, I suppose, to my initial question that I asked you about. Here you are as kind of a quasi-outsider, and you're never going to quite have that precise idea of what it is to be a Gloucester local. You know?
But I live there a few months of the year, and I've been hanging out there asking questions for a very long time.
Okay.
And they're pretty much used to me. And people like the Sicilian guy who has a little cafe that I got some recipes from, and Some local people were amazed that I got recipes from him because he's very secretive like that. He never gives recipes. He doesn't talk much to his customers. He's probably in the wrong business, you know. But
bribery, cajoling. You
know, no, I mean, I'm a guy who's always in there drinking drinking espresso and talking to them, you know. Yeah. So they're used to me.
Yeah. Gotcha. Well, Mark, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks so much for taking the time out.
Yeah, very nice talking to you.
Great, thanks. Going fishing all of the time. Baby going fishing too. That's your life, your sweet wife. Catch more fish than you. Many fish bites if you got good bait. Here's a little tip that I would like to relate. Many fish bites if you got good bait. I'm a going fishing, yes, I'm going fishing, and my baby going fishing too. I went on down to my favorite fishing hole, baby grabbed me.